Today's episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you, in part, by Feels. Sponsors like Feels help keep the lights on here at Bladder Presents HQ, so check them out at feals.com and keep an ear out for that promo code later in the episode. And that episode starts right now.
We went into the bathroom, and behind the toilet there was the envelope.
I don't know why they always have to hide that stuff in toilets, but it stank terribly. It was so awful.
Cameraman and editor Miles Hargrove had the foresight to record his family as they labored through the ordeal that was his father's kidnapping by FARC guerrillas. Is the documentary that results, Miracle Fishing, more labored than love? Also, Netflix's Exhibit A posits that not all forensic science is forensic or science, but is sitting through the entire limited series a trial of its own? Pablo Escobar, CSI, and Jeb Lund on The Bladder Presents, episode 148. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. Accompanying me on this week's Dead Drop is returning guest Jeb Lund. Hello, Jeb.
Hello. Delighted to be here, as ever.
I feel like that's not entirely true. Why, you ask? Let's get into it with our Most Wanted section. Before we started this record, we were joking that Jeb had a note on each of our properties that we're discussing today, and that note was basically nope. So let's see if I was actually right about that. We are talking about Miracle Fishing, a documentary that was just at AFI Docs over last weekend. I am not sure when this will be widely available, but I suspect that it will show up on PBS sooner rather than later. Here's the case file in the meantime. Quote, the story of a father's kidnapping as told through the 1994 video diaries of his son. Not much more to it than that. Per Wikipedia, quote, in 1991, Thomas Hargrove began working for the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, the CIAT, in Cali, Colombia. While driving to work on September 23, 1994, he encountered a roadblock set up by FARC guerrillas who kidnapped him at gunpoint. Hargrove was considered a high-value prisoner because the semi-literate guerrillas thought his CIAT identification badge was proof that he was actually working for the CIA. And the title Miracle Fishing comes from what these guerrillas were doing, which was casting a pretty wide net in terms of roadblocks and hoping for a high-value kidnap target to blunder into the net. The film Proof of Life was based on this story, sans the Russell Crowe, Meg Ryan drama, one assumes. And Miracle Fishing, like I said, was programmed at the AFI Online Virtual Doc Festival. That's how we saw it. Like I said, also unclear on where this is playing or will be playing going forward, but let's worry about that after we tell you whether you should bother setting a search for it on your DVR. I liked this one a lot.
Good. I had a qualified... Good. No, like...
Jeb's happy I think, for me.
I think you took my negative thing in Slack about the our kind of B team for this episode to also reflect on this doc. And I didn't feel that way. I thought this was... I mean, qualified endorsement, I think there's some definite misses, but... This is something you're not going to see anywhere else. You might be familiar with the story, but it is coming at a story, a true story like this from this perspective is extraordinarily rare. I can't imagine where you would see a lot more like it. And I mean, just sort of a happy happenstance. I kind of wish somebody who wasn't that personally involved could have parachuted in a little bit more and said, you know, that's less interesting than you think. This is more interesting. Why isn't this here?
Yeah, but at the same time, I think it is not interesting. Well, it is interesting, but the mom in this scenario, I think, comes off in this, let's say, bizarre way. Like, she is sort of extremely human and unique as all humans are, but I'm wondering if, like, if you had a sort of third party filmmaker who wasn't involved as closely, like you said, if you would get that sense of her, I don't know what the word is. Like, she's kind of a weirdo, and the way that I mean, you know, who among us, but like the way that her specific weirdosity operates in the context of her husband having been kidnapped and her fucking college age kids and their friend running this like year long op to get him back. I don't know. I'm not sure that you would get that. I think they might be like, oh, this doesn't show her to the best effect. And they would have cut some stuff that was interesting.
Yeah. The clip that you played to start us off where they're going and doing the dead drop in the toilet, like there really isn't a whole lot of interrogation of the fact that they have these kids running out and picking up a dead drop. I mean, they're not kids, but they're her kids. And there's a level of possessiveness and concern that you would hope she had to go through before she assented to this. And I'd like to see that in part. A lot of these decisions that are made in, you know, as they're handling the dad's kidnapping and here's how we're going to keep, you know, the Colombian government off our back. Here's how we're going to have to, you know, do these various things that you wouldn't normally think of on a checklist. Cause like who among us is used to like, all right, when dad is kidnapped, here's what we're going to do. It's not a plan that you make, like what you do in case there's a fire in the house or something. And so like kind of the process of getting to these smart decisions would, I think, have been equally as engrossing.
Well, I think there is some commentary on that, but it's commentary and not interrogation, as you suggested. Let me just jump ahead to clip 3 and play that where this family friend is like, well, they threw me in the car also because I just looked like this, you know, bubby from Plainfield, New Jersey, and what could go wrong? Here's clip 3.
Wish us luck.
Take it, Billy.
Yeah, Billy, good luck, son.
Yes, absolutely.
Susan and I were very concerned because, you know, the children were going to do this, and it was incredibly scary. I mean, we thought, God, you know, it shouldn't just be the kids. So, you know, we talked to David about it, and we said, you know, we just think there should be some adults. And he says to me, yeah, well, maybe you ought to go. You know, you're old, and you wear all that leopard stuff. Nobody's ever going to think you're carrying ransom money. So I went. Okay, here Giddy and I are in the car. We have one little screw-up. We don't have the cellular. They're going to go back and get the cellular. Giddy and I are totally cool. We're sitting here with $200,000. On a Saturday morning. Yes, indeed he do.
And then the kid, Getty, Miles's brother, is like, eh-heh. Like, it's your fucking embarrassing Dutch aunt. Like, we've all been on this adventure with the sibling who won't stop taping stuff because for whatever reason. Except it's usually just some bullshit. Like, you're driving somebody to a tennis lesson. You're not, like, in Colombia arranging for a ransom drop. And there was just something so, like, there are long stretches where they're waiting around to hear from the kidnappers, that they've been told that they can talk to the point man on this CB radio frequency in, like, 2 weeks. So they're waiting around to do that, and then they're just, like, sitting around, like, drinking and arguing over music and playing cards and having dinner parties with everyone who's around. And it's like, well, but sure. Like, I don't know. I just found that very, like, relatable, and I guess charming is not the right word in this situation, but I thought that was interesting. Like, how does a family in this situation behave during the times when there's just nothing to be done except have cocktails and play fuck your buddy?
Right. I mean, I don't even necessarily need some of this stuff, like, seriously interrogated. I would just like to see kind of the chaos that existed for a little bit before they settled into this routine. Like, you talk about the mother just being odd, and of course, like, they get her friend, the kind of, like, weird family aunt, and the mom is sort of in that group, you know, like the sort of, you know, like the friend's mom you would know growing up who had a whole room set aside to, like, a craft. and didn't own a TV or something, and like had putting her in charge of a kidnapping. It's got that kind of vibe. I'd like to see like where they, how they got to the point where they were like, Mom, we need you to just stay upstairs. Like what happened? What was her behavior like? Like I can understand like maybe she's too emotional to process this and contribute well. So yeah, you know, get her, you know, upstairs and have her wait. But like, was there a precipitating event? Was there something embarrassing? Like maybe that would indicate some of the stress that that's there apart from they're just sort of saying like, we're really stressed.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. And I think there is a whole sequence in this film where, they've done the first drop, nothing happens. He's not released. And apparently this was fairly common that it was like, all right, we'll take whatever you negotiated for the first time. And then we're going to ask for more because if you could get that much, you could probably get more. And this was like common practice. And it's somewhere in there that Susan is like tying a bandana to a golf club. And she's like, fuck this. I'm going to go get him myself. I'm going to walk towards those mountains where they think the transmission's coming from. And the whole household is like, no. And they talk her out of it. But there is a lack of spiking panic there that makes me think that she's just that guy. Who's like, it's like, Ma, where are you going? The White House. I'm going to give that fucker a piece of my mind. And you're like, could someone not get the car? Because this is not good. but there, I mean, you have to wonder if the fact that the kids were, you know, the kids were in charge of this, and not for nothing, but 1994 fashion and how gigantic it was. Like everybody's wearing these XXL t-shirts and cargo shorts that make them look even younger because they're swimming in them. Yeah. You have to wonder if that wasn't just the default in this family. That, like, you know, Mom is a deep thinker, but practically speaking, we're just going to take this over.
Right. Yeah. She says at some point, you know, the kids quit their, you know, quit college for the term to come down here and do this. And we don't see how they got to that decision too, because I mean, like realistically, how much are they going to be able to do at that time? You know, most kids aren't going to become disinvested. You know, how do they reach that decision? Maybe what some of the consequences were for them, because that might underline like the conclusion that you just came to, like, yeah, maybe Mom's just a little bit too impractical and she's the eccentric family member and the kids will come down here and keep her grounded. They're the sort of people who make lists.
Yeah. And you also wonder, these were, kids who had been living overseas, like they're, you know, American citizens, but they've been living overseas based on their parents' work pretty much their whole lives. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if Thomas Hargrove is no longer living, not as a result of this debacle, as it turns out. But you have to wonder if he were alive and were sitting for this, if he'd be like, oh yeah, the boys had standing instructions that if anything like legit happened, that they were to drop everything and come back here so that Susan didn't do something artsy, didn't do something craftsy with the situation. Did you feel like there was enough like context or background as to what the FARC guerrillas, like who they were, what they did? Did you feel like that was adequate and that the focus was mostly on this family?
I think there's enough in there to get by. I think one of the things I was thinking when I was watching this was I was looking at the running time and it's about an hour 40. And I think it could have been, with what it has and what it does, since it very much is, and you can hear it from that soundtrack, that that kind of propulsive beat. It's very procedural almost. And as a procedural doc that doesn't explore some of these ancillary things, I think you could have cut it down to, you know, like 120. If you're going to do that running time, yeah, I would like to see more about, you know, how did the FARC get into this position? How did they know? How did the family know how to deal with that? Maybe some of the context for arriving at these decisions, whether it's personal, like the kids maybe having standing orders from dad, or, you know, how did they become kind of acculturated to what's going on? Like, I think I get the sense that, you know, they're there kind of at the height of violence from the Cali cartel. And, you know, maybe just from reading the newspapers, so like, yeah, well, we know this. Like, the newspaper used to print best practices on, like,
right.
what you do if a family member has been kidnapped. There was, like, a Slate explainer on it or something. Like, then it would be, I'd be like, okay, great, sure, keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I didn't really feel the running time until the end, but I agree that, like, maybe 100 minutes is, like, on the longer end of what it needed to be. I will say that maybe this is just me feeling rather fondly towards this documentary and wanting it to be in on its own jokes, but I did feel like some of those music cues, like I left the opening clip long for a reason, to leave that like dun 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 nonsense in there while some guy's like, why do they always leave it in the shitter? Like, that's a good point. Why do they do that? But then there's this like Mission Impossible thing happening in the background. I would like to think that that was intentional. I also enjoyed that even at the time, Miles and other people in the room have the presence of mind to narrate for the video camera the processy stuff that's happening with mm-hmm. like with this situation. Like, all right, next we do, you know, go to our friend Helga's house. I have a clip, and it's a little long, but I just enjoyed, like, this is what I would do in that situation, is be like, all right, here's what's happening. It's like TV in the following ways. Here's clip four.
We had to face a high probability that our money delivery will be caught by police in one of those roadblocks. So we thought about how can we hide this money in the car.
If only the neighbors knew what was going on behind that door.
Look at this. I've never seen this, my God.
We wound up to put it into wooden pallets, so it looked like a normal Colombian delivery.
Come on, Hoover.
It's 5:20, and we're still waiting for instructions as to where we can get a drop map from them before we can send the money out. In case anybody's listening to our phones, David's come up with a plan where when they contact us, we're going to give them a number of our friend Helga, who then will pass on a number to David's apartment, where David and Robert are going to be waiting to take further instructions. David calls it a three-way switch.
David is the, I think, the Russell Crowe guy equivalent.
There's two Davids. There's David Little and David Parkinson, and they're both kidnapping and rescue consultants, and they don't really specify which one when they're talking about it.
Yeah. And then there's Oscar, yeah. who is the more local guy who I think brought in the Davids.
Yeah, he's the ex-FBI guy who does the legatee security, I guess.
Right.
Was the what they said.
So, but yeah, it's mostly like it's Getty and it's, you know, Auntie and it's Robert. Peter,
mm-hmm. Uli, Peter and Roberts, Miles,
the friend who is who's running the radio. Basically, he's like the comms chief. He's like 23, and then everyone's just kind of like sitting around in their garden that they strung Edison bulbs up in, and like passing the time. I mean, I think that your take on it up top was absolutely right. Like, there is really no other project like this. There's no other documentary that does this, and I was interested and I liked these people, and I still found it, like, I did a little Googling and I knew how it was going to turn out, but I still found it suspenseful.
Yeah, no, I think they did a really good job of with the documentary they decided to tell. They did a really good job of, like, again, the propulsiveness and pacing, even though I knew the outcome, I wasn't sitting there going like, okay, well, this part's a little thick. You know, just the little moments they could have trimmed off here and there, maybe to include some other stuff. I guess, like, my bottom line is I think anybody who watches this will find it unique and enjoy it. I think everybody will probably have something that they wish they had a little bit more of in there, but I don't know as if we'd all agree on what that would be.
Yeah, I think that's right. So let me wrap up with one last clip from this section, which illustrates, I think, how Susan receives the world on a different frequency from most, let's say, in clip five.
They don't come at night, do they? I mean, don't they let him out in the early morning or in the middle of the day or something?
They'll let him out somewhere near a road and tell him, here, there'll be a bus passing in 20 minutes, and they give him 5,000 pesos and say, go find the bus.
What happens if he's sick? How can they put him on a bus?
Susan, you don't understand. They don't care.
You just get the feeling that this is like version 17 that week of right. this conversation where she'll just like float into the room wearing a caftan. I don't know why I'm writing mental fanfic about this person, but anyway, in her wooden jewelry. We all knew this person. She just
her clogs.
Yeah. One of which has a little, the sole is like flapping loose and you're like, will you please just crazy glue it? And she's like, it's fine. The universe provides. She just floats into a room and is like, well, what if, I mean, you have to have shoes on to ride the bus. So what if they took his shoes? And they're like, Susan, they don't care.
Yeah, that seemed to be like the spoken version of what I kind of wondered, where, like you said, people narrating what's going on to the camera. Like, I imagine that there are a lot of cuts that we didn't see where somebody's like, well, right now what we're doing, and somebody else is like, we already fucking explained it. Or, you know, like somebody who'd already said it earlier, but this person doesn't think they summarized it quite well. Like, who decided that they were the narrator? Like, how many times did it get on somebody's nerves? How many times did they blow it? Like, you know, how many times was it like, you're jinxing us by saying that what we're about to do is this? I mean, there was a jinx moment. And as soon as I heard it, like as a sports fan, I was just like, but like how many other ones of those must there have been, you know?
Wait, what were you like? there you go. Yeah, no, there were a couple like that, and there were definitely like you can tell that this was not that sort of rigorously organized at the time by Miles because of just the sheer amount of footage of the pets, which is hilarious that it's like it just occasionally turns into an Instagram about their dogs, which, okay, I'm here for that. This is definitely in terms of like a change of pace from what I'm usually watching and how I'm usually thinking about this material. This was great. I enjoyed it. And I hope that listeners, you are able to find it sometime soon. It's called Miracle Fishing and it is made by Miles Hargrove and his family and their pets. Anything else to add before we?
No, I think we got it.
Step around to the negative. All right. Well, we'll be moving on to the cold case section in a moment. But before we do that, a word from our sponsor. What is Feels? Feels, with an A, is a better way to feel better. Feels' premium CBD will keep your head clear and help you feel your best. CBD has been proven to reduce anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. And while I'm prone to anxiety even in the best of times, the last few months have been not the best of anything. Feels has helped me do less staring at the ceiling, less worrying about worrying, and more focusing on the post-it hydra that is my to-do list. Navigating the world of CBD might seem complicated if you're new to it, but Feels helps you do less worrying about that, too. Feels is there to help simplify the process, with a CBD hotline offering real human support on where to start and how to find the best dosage for you. And wherever you end up in that discovery process, Feels is a cinch to take. Just place a few drops under your tongue and you'll feel the difference in minutes. That's it. No titration, no other prep. Feels works naturally. You won't feel any high or hangover, and you won't get addicted. And Feels' hassle-free membership program is a cinch, too. Feels is shipped direct to your doorstep every month. Members save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel anytime you like. Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you, too. Become a member today and get 50% off your first order with free shipping. Head to feels.com/blotter. That's feals.com/blotter, BLOTTER, to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order and free shipping. feals.com/blotter. Thanks, Feels. All right, it's about to get, I suspect, quite a bit more negative in here with our cold case section. We are talking about Exhibit A. Here is the case file from Wikipedia. Quote, Exhibit A is a four-part English language documentary TV series that premiered on Netflix in June of 2019, created and directed by Kelly Loudenberg. It explores how forensic techniques, tools, and evidence such as blood spatter, touch DNA, cadaver dogs, and CCTV footage can be misinterpreted and manipulated to have potentially innocent people convicted. End quote. Loudenberg also created the confession tapes, which took a similar angle, but only on false confessions. I talked about that in episode 23 with A.B. Chow. I quite enjoyed both of those series, but it seems the Lund household was underwhelmed. I got a note from Jeb after episode one that was like, hey, our household, nope. Did matters improve at all? Did you even keep watching?
We gave it one more episode and it was the same thing again, which is that I think all of this is interesting. And I think it's, you know, obviously important to know about rather than go with the kind of TV narrative about how efficacious forensics is on slamming the doors on people. Uh-huh. But it very much felt like a victim of peak TV. Almost all of these, I think, could be 15, or it could be like 12 minute segments in something that ran, you know, like an hour long. They probably could have hacked almost all these segments down and done them for the broadcast. Because once you get used to the format, there's kind of one trick. I mean, we're just going through like, do you know what this is? Great. Well, here's how it gets debunked. That's right. Very interesting to me, and I'd like to see more of it. But, you know, the first episode, I'm watching it, and I'm thinking, well, it's, you know, 47 minutes or something. That's about the same amount of time you could dedicate to reading like a 20-page New Yorker article on the exact same phenomenon.
Yeah.
And come away with not only knowing what they're explaining, but knowing like five times that amount.
Yeah, that's true. That's not a bad point. And I think the first episode, I don't understand why it's so long and why they led with that one. Because if you're thinking about like forensic disciplines that have been challenged in the last couple of 3 years, what is the first thing that you think of? Not videometry.
No, and not in the way that they ultimately, I think, challenged it too.
Yeah.
But more on that.
Well, I think that they choose, Loudenberg chooses in every episode to start with the expert in the discipline and then to kind of travel backwards. And this, you know, whoever it is sounds perfectly reasonable, knowledgeable, trustworthy. You have, you know, your innate pattern recognition has no reason to, like, be cynical about their bona fides or anything that they're saying. There is one exception there. But then the episode goes on to pick out a case that kind of gives the lie to whatever this expert has just told you about. So that's, you know, that's a choice. That structure. I think that it's appropriate for this material, but at the same time, like, she's trying to undercut their authority. That's the whole point of the project. But at the same time, a lot of the things that they're saying are informative and not inaccurate. Like, here's clip 6 from episode 1, the videography one. That's like, okay, I knew this information, but thank you for repackaging it for me in a pertinent way here. Maybe that's the point, is that these experts are able to sort of lull me with like, let me explain to you a few things. So here's clip 6.
Every one of us is holding a evidence collection device, a camera, in our phones.
You don't touch me. You don't touch me.
And so it's becoming a more important part of criminal and civil investigations. The first thing that a person needs to understand when they look at video is that it's made up of a series of still images. Video is not motion. Video is just a picture, then a picture, then a picture, separated by time. But there are many frailties with digital video evidence. When you look at a surveillance video and you see somebody firing a weapon and you only see two muzzle flashes, doesn't mean only two shots were fired. Some of those shots might have happened between image capture. So if you have a high resolution image with multiple images per second, you'll perceive maybe all shots. That changes the evidence. It changes the meaning of the images.
Yeah, it does. Jeb, what did you think of this, or if you thought anything in particular, of this decision to sort of put the experts in front and then from behind them kind of be like, you know, to kind of well actually what they're saying?
Having not completed the series, I don't know if it wears poorly. I like that in the first one, because I think we're all kind of conditioned to think that we're somewhat experts from having watched a lot of Law and Order or Criminal Minds or what have you. Like, we just osmotically have kind of like taken in all this cop and kind of CSI argot and, you know, speak authoritatively about it. Like, I think, you know, when we read about, let's say, to pick something, I don't know, maybe relevant, like cop officer involved shootings, right?
Right.
And we're armchair analyzing the data and we're going like, well, this is good evidence, but you can't trust those eyewitnesses. And it's nice to kind of impeach ourselves, and it does it passively enough that like it's not just sort of going like, hey, Rube, like you fell for it. But, you know, we kind of get lulled in and then go, wait a minute. And that's good. I think the only drawback to that is in the first one, especially, I kind of thought of like, here's some even more avenues we could go on. And if you weren't going to explore as much as I think you could have, that felt even more stretched.
Like
the content
what?
Of that episode. Well, so when you have the guy who's interpreting the video, who we initially think like this guy is on the level, and then we slowly kind of like impeach his credibility. Well, he's explaining how he analyzes this data by saying, well, we just put it in the algorithm. The right. algorithm does it. The program does it. And so this guy is like not even necessarily capable of understanding the kind of evidence he's gathering from like a non-digitized, like just a purely like hands-on, here's what's measured kind of way.
Right. Like if you gave him a slide rule and you're like, well, what does the algorithm do? He'd be like,
right.
It does what it does. QED.
And like, and this is just like height examination, you know, like trying to guesstimate what a suspect's frame must have been. And it's not like some other algorithms we've seen recently that have been in the news. And like, you know, I think this is also relevant for the purposes of law enforcement, where you see like these algorithms that are supposed to be agnostic because they're made by white people.
Yes.
Have these built-in racial blindnesses. And so you teach the algorithm to be as racist as you are because you're not aware of what you're teaching it. Now, we're not going to see that here necessarily, because I don't think there's necessarily like a height prejudice there. But just that idea of like not really kind of questioning even the accuracy of the tool that you're using to do it. Like you're surrendering, you're outsourcing like the interpretation of this data to something whose like priors we don't know how they were established.
Yeah. This is something that I talked about. I reviewed a film last week called Coded Bias, and it's talking about exactly that facial recognition software is extremely problematic because everything in AI from the jump has been sort of thought of and built by white dudes. So facial recognition is really good at white dudes, and then everyone else is shit out of luck if it matches you up with some rap sheet that's not yours. There's also the matter of like judges not really understanding sometimes what the technology or what the science means. So there's like this magical thinking element around it, but there's also, you know, a lot of certifications in law enforcement is shit that you can do in 10 hours in your underpants online. So, I think this is the appeals attorney, went on a rant in episode one about this guy's, you know, corrupt analysis of the animation. So here's, I'm just going to jump to clip 8.
His animation was, I think, particularly fraudulent, but impressive to the jurors. I mean, it's like showing an animation of a small person growing into a big person, you know, and saying, see, that proves it can be done or something. Most of his testimony is filtered through the mysterious software of PhotoModeler, which he had not even been trained on when he did his report.
PhotoModeler is the fastest, most powerful, and affordable way to turn your photos into 3D data.
So he knew what he wanted to say ultimately. And it couldn't be too outrageous and say, this guy's exactly 6'3". He says this guy's at least 6'1 1/8". He put that in there to make it sound like he really knew what he was talking about. That is absolute bunk.
I'm just glad here in the 21st century that people are describing things as bunk still. But yeah. I thought that was an interesting addition to the conversation, that it's like, you know, not only is he just letting the algorithm sort of think for him and being like, see, but he's also trying to convince jurors via a neighborhood play, basically, that it's like, well, he's tall, he's this tall or taller, because if he says it's the guy's exactly 6'3", then it seems too coincidental. But this way, it has more authority because there's like a margin. So that was kind of interesting to me.
That seemed kind of defense attorney-ish though, like that, like, well, he must have been doing the 1/8. Like, I mean, admittedly, this guy sucks, but like, I don't know, being on the journalism end of that, when somebody, you put out a story and somebody says, well, they obviously did it for the clicks on this, and you're like, no, we did it because there are 8 spots we got to fill every day, and this is something that people gave a shit about. Like, I mean, the implication that you know why it turned out this way, like, I that always rankles me. Like, the 1/8 really could have just come out of the computer as is. And you're like, well, fuck, I got to write it down. Fuck it. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I bought that explanation.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it's like, you know, if you're lying, be vague. give as few details as possible. Then you can't get caught with something. Like, I don't know. That sort of tracked with that for me. I also enjoyed about this show that the talking head interviewees were, you know, when you watch enough of these like Dateline-y type shows, but even in like more prestige material, you're dealing with subjects who often have been over the story many times. They understand what's expected of them. They are aware of the milieu in which they're operating, and there is a, not soundbitey, but just a much more polished quality than most of the people that Lautenberg talks to for this. And so I pulled a clip because this one eyewitness is like, you know, I don't know from software. I'm just telling you, it wasn't him. And then her nickname for all the customers, like Chip Guy, was just funny to me. So here's clip 7.
From across the store, it kind of freaked me out. He had sunglasses on, like the guy. But once I got up close, I totally knew, because like I say, I have to look up at George this way. So once I got up to him, the other guy, we were like eye to eye. George was through that door every single day. I called him the CD guy. There was Chip guy, there was Pepsi guy, there was Coke guy, and they all knew it, and everyone got a chuckle out of it. So when we were questioned by the actual detectives, they started saying George's name. If we looked anywhere else on the mugshot, they just kept pointing us towards George. They were just so focused on him. And I even asked them that, you know, why? Why do you want him? He didn't do this. I guarantee you, he's way taller than the guy.
Unfortunately, because of the nature of this series, they sort of glossed over how many times that, in addition to the forensics not necessarily being like the gold standard that the jury is told, that cops are misusing tools like the photo array. In this case, I think they strongly urged George's then wife to dime him to Crime Stoppers so she could get the reward. Like, but because that's not forensic, then it's like, well, either more about that or less about that. Did you feel the same way or no?
Totally. Yeah. They introduce kind of a running argument in there that you might have heard from if you followed the Ferguson protests and what was going on in Ferguson. Like, there's a running bit on how the cops are essentially using base personnel as a piggy bank because it's a Texas, it's Killeen, Texas, right? They're not going to raise taxes there. So they're just like collecting $1,000 fee for reckless driving that immediately goes in the city coffers. And like, that's a problem around the US, especially in communities that refuse to raise taxes, but still want more cops. But we don't really talk about that. It's sort of brought up as like, well, you know that this is an existing problem. Yes. Okay. And yeah. I mean, more of that, or maybe like, don't go back to that well as much. Cause it is, it's 47 minutes for like kind of a half an hour plot.
Yeah. And then there's the other issue is that like George Powell as a personage is this like I had him in my notes as messianic David Silver, which is like not accurate, but it's sort of as close as you're gonna get. And then when they show his rap sheet, which I got a screen grab and you can see that in the visual aids, which will be on Twitter at Blotter Presents, his rap sheet is like just this bogue fundraising shit that you were just saying. Like, one of the charges was literally failure to leave a parking lot silently. Like,
Jesus.
Like, yeah, so they're like, all right, move along. You're soliciting and that's not allowed. And he apparently was like, fuck you. And so you get written up for that. And that's the bake sale in Killeen, Texas, I guess, is yeah. to just ding guys like this over and over again for little bullshit and then lock them up when they don't pay the stupid fines. Like I said, I liked the series more than you did. I watched the whole thing. Episode 2 is about blood spatter, which you'd think they would lead with. They didn't. And there's the following interesting exchange with a juror on this case of this woman who after 25 years was sent to jail, now a grandma, because of a single dot of they don't even know whose blood on her ancient nightgown. Do TV shows affect jurors' perceptions of science at trial? Doy, clip 9.
Had you ever heard of blood spatter evidence?
Well, I've heard it on TV, but I didn't actually go through every little aspect of how they did with the microscope and the directions.
Had you watched Dexter?
My wife did quite a bit. That was her favorite show. So she wanted to hear about it after trial was over, so I got to tell her some stuff about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's not the problem with our criminal justice quote system in a nutshell, but it's one of them.
Right. Yeah. First of all, this person, their favorite show is Dexter, and they're walking free.
I know. And, come on, man.
Yeah. Lady, please.
I know. Your favorite show doesn't get to be a Showtime show. That's not how life works. This is America.
But yeah, I remember reading that in like the last third of Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets. I mean, just the absolute exasperation that prosecutors had that audiences were trained, not audiences, juries were trained by being TV audiences that like when somebody did it, you were going to get like 3 or 4 clean prints. You were going to get a blood type and all this stuff. And like now it seems like it's after years of the TV saturation, it's kind of gone maybe the other way where now even like the most minuscule problematic, like, you know, extremely conditional evidence is seen as a slam dunk because we've been taught by watching Gil Grissom, like, you know, bow leg into a room and go, I didn't convict you. The evidence did.
Insert rock scream. Yeah. I mean, like, and that's definitely got to be a problem. And you just have to wonder, having been called for the jury pool, it like filled out my thing. And then it was like 2 hours later, they're like, don't come back here. Like true crime podcast. Get out. I don't actually know the reason, but they're like, well, maybe we'll see you in 6 years if everyone else dies. Like, they just don't, they don't pick me. Anyway, I think this is probably a huge problem because not only do you have the people whose favorite shows are Dexter, but you also have the, like, John Munches of the world who are myriad, who are like, how do we know that wasn't planted? Like, I mean, how do we know anything?
Like, or yeah, like just taking calculus and going like, well, actually, the standard deviation on a radar gun is dismissed.
No. Dismissed from human society. Goodbye. I was surprised not to see an episode on arson. Were you?
Yeah. Like, well, in part because, I mean, it's just sort of foremost in my mind because we talked about that one New Yorker article on the fire, like the burn pattern analysis.
Yes.
And that just seemed to be one of those things where it also has gotten really kind of certain seeming from drama TV. But we have a really perfect and like heartbreaking example of how the understanding of the science has changed and how much of it is more art than not.
Yeah. And that, you know, I feel like Cameron Todd Willingham comes up frequently on this podcast, and that occasionally guests will be like, well, have you ever done a, you know, if I'm asking, what do you want to do for the cold case? Like, have you done this? Yes. Like, do you need to talk about it with me off mic? Because it, like, it really sticks with people, that case. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if Loudenberg didn't feel like the very New Yorker article that we're, like, literally talking about covered that subject, and that the pitiless coverage by Frontline also was like, you know, I'm not going to step to that. Or maybe she was like, well, I'll save that for a season two. I don't know. But I was a little surprised and disappointed not to see an arson case there. I am going to close with an episode from a clip from episode 3, which is about cadaver dogs. And someone early on makes the point that they're sort of like a lie detector test. It's not evidentiary, but it sort of might point you in the direction of something. And then that's not really followed up on, that the idea that that can cut both ways. So that was a little frustrating to me, but we did get some, I don't know how to classify this. The woman talking in this clip is the mother of a child who disappeared. The dad got locked up for it, based in no small part on cadaver dog analysis. His ex has some pretty interesting insights on who gets focused on in situations like this in clip 10.
Because he had a past that, you know, some things he had did when he was younger, a record. It made it much easier to paint him as a bad guy that would do bad things. I don't have that checkered past. I'm a veteran. I'm a homeowner. I volunteer. I'm a Girl Scout. God damn it. You can't go to court and paint me as a bad, bad person that does bad, bad things. I bake.
Benica 2020. I bake. I'm just going to start using that in response to all kinds of things. Dude, it's your turn to take the trash out. No, it isn't. I bake. I don't bake.
Man, I want to pull that rank.
I got something in the oven right now. You take the trash out. Well, I'm sorry that you did not enjoy this, but it doesn't seem like you hated it. You just think it's inessential. Is that accurate?
It kind of made me wish that Netflix had the 1.5 speed button.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just like a little shaggy. And if you're not going to follow up on the things I would like you to follow up on, like, let me kind of zip through it. But yeah, I mean, if it's not something you've covered before, I imagine it would be edifying, and maybe the shaggier bits would just flash right by. So
I think that's actually an extremely good assessment, because now that you mention it, a 1.5 button really would have been perfect for this. Then this would have felt like you said, it just breezes right by, and you don't feel as much the missed opportunity. So yeah. All right. Well, Exhibit A, I mean, it's a great name, you got to admit. I'm shocked that nothing else was named that already, but Exhibit A is available on Netflix as we speak.
In local news today, bees. Mm-hmm.
As we are speaking, Jeb, where else can listeners find you and your work?
Well, I have a Hallmark-related podcast with David J. Roth of The New Republic, formerly of Deadspin, where we try to be very gentle but review them wholly sincerely and crack each other up. It's not about anything bad that's happening in the world pretty much at all. So if you want to experience some media that is not going to make you anxious about pretty much anything other than like how enormous your cake is, we're your hookup. And that's Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean, available on pretty much all the podcast platforms, I think.
Very good. Jeb and I are also endeavoring to co-host Quaid in Full Season 2, which is dropping this Friday, I believe, our first episode on The Long Rider. So look out for that.
Yeah.
That's a lot of Sarah for you for 1 week. Thank you for wading back in.
Oh, no, but hey, look, I wouldn't have agreed to the Quaid in Full thing if I didn't know what I was getting into. So, you know.
I mean, you say that, and yet, gorp. We'll get into it. Speaking of things we'll get into, coming up on The Blotter Presents, Mike Dunn, my official Garden State, Golden State killer correspondent, returns to talk about I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Then I'm off the next week for staycation, and then someone's talking about something called Murder Trial, and then something else is happening, probably involving Toby coming down from the roof. Who can say? I can say this. If you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter every weekday. That's bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extra reviews and Blotter briefs, teehee briefs, so sign up today. Today's episode was sponsored by Feels. Check the show notes for a link for half off that first order. My guest has been Jeb Lund, and he is on Twitter at Mobute. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.